And good evening and welcome to Outbeat Collage. I'm Michaela Kennan. Have we got a show for you tonight? I will tell you. We bring together an unorthodox blend of humor and compassion, all in the name of a higher calling, on tonight's program. In just a few moments, I'll be speaking with R. Dale Smith, Robbie Dale Smith. He is a writer, a performer, and self-proclaimed Jesus freak, who will be bringing his one-man comedy show to Santa Rosa in just a few weeks. Plus, we'll have a conversation with Susan Castlin. She is the author of a just-released book about the life of Richard Purcell, a gay Franciscan priest who was also an advocate for homeless men living with AIDS in the Mission District of San Francisco. My co-host Gary is traveling this week. I'm here tonight with Mary Moore Campagna on the engineering boards. Let's go right to Greg Moralia and the Outbeat News.
Good evening, this is Greg Moralia with your Outbeat Radio News for Sunday, April 15th, 2012. Despite mounting pressure from LGBT advocates, President Barack Obama is unlikely to sign an executive order barring federal contractors from anti-LGBT discrimination. A senior administration official said Wednesday that the White House would continue to engage corporate America in pushing for the Employment Non-Discrimination Act, a long-pending bill that would ban employment discrimination on the basis of sexual orientation and gender identity. He said, "We do not expect an executive order on LGBT non-discrimination for federal contractors will be issued at this time. We are deeply committed to working hand-in-hand with the LGBT community to enlist support from key stakeholders and other decision-makers, and to continue to engage with and to educate the business community and the public more broadly about the importance of employment non-discrimination and the importance of passing ENDA." Human Rights Campaign President Joe Solomonese said, "We're extremely disappointed with this decision, and we will continue to advocate for an executive order from the president. The unfortunate truth is that hardworking Americans can be fired simply for being gay or transgender. Given the number of employees that would be covered by this executive order, it represents a critical step forward." And here locally, the Russian River Sisters have revealed the winners of their most recent grants. They include a long list of beneficiaries, including West County Health Centers, Forestville Teen Clinic, Russian River Senior Resource Center, Guerneville West, the Forestville Wellness Center, KGGV Radio, Pioneer High School Project Graduation, Food for Thought, Sadie's House Rescue, Becoming Independent, PALS, El Molino High School Music Program, KOWS Community Radio, the Russian River Firefighters Association, L.C. Allen High School Music Program, Community Clean, Sonoma County Hepatitis AIDS Risk Reduction Program, Turning Deserts into Forests, Face to Face, AIDS Emergency Fund, the Martial Arts Youth Institute, Community Action Partnership, Youth Build, Friends Outside Sonoma County, and the West County Community Services Adventures for Kids. These beneficiaries were celebrated at the sisters' April 6th anniversary party at the Rio Nido Roadhouse. This year's award presentation coincided with the sisters' 11th anniversary celebration. Refreshments and entertainment made for an enjoyable evening. Also, there were recognition awards presented to local community benefactors as well as financial grant awardees. Sister Sparkle Plenty, a founder of the local order, said, "We sisters began by building bridges with seniors, local schools, sheriffs, and firefighters associations and advocacy groups. By attending and creating events, we were able to accomplish several goals. Primarily, we were able to raise our community's awareness of the struggles that were going on around them. Since its inception, the Russian River Sisters of Perpetual Indulgence has found ways of accumulating and dispersing monies to needy groups and individuals, and the Russian River Sisters grant program is just one means of channeling financial help. Some of the money comes from donations, and the rest comes from the sisters' vigorous fundraising campaigns. The Sisters is a nonprofit and volunteer organization that gives 100% of the donations they receive to worthy groups, programs, and service providers. Their grant program began in 2003. Here's your calendar events for the coming week. On Monday, April 16th, from 7 to 8:30 p.m., Jesse's parent support group will meet at the Positive Images Center, 312 Chin Street in Santa Rosa. Also on Monday, the Sonoma County Pride Planning Committee will convene at 7 p.m. at Marshall House, 15010 Armstrong Woods Road in Guerneville. Everyone is welcome to help plan this year's parade and festival. On Tuesday, April 17th, from 6 to 7:30 p.m., the trans group will meet at the Positive Images Center in Santa Rosa. And on Thursday, April 19th, from 9:30 a.m. until 11 a.m., Spectrum hosts the Novato Senior Breakfast at Sam's Place, 1545 South Novato Boulevard in Novato. And on Friday, April 20th at 10:30 a.m., the Sonoma Valley Seniors Group will meet at Vintage House Senior Center, 264 First Street in Sonoma. The Spectrum Group meets for lively discussions, mutual support, and sharing information. And finally, on Saturday, April 21st, from 10 a.m. until 5 p.m., the Food for Thought Food Drive will happen at the 4th Street Safeway in Santa Rosa, the Guerneville Safeway, and at Oliver's in Santa Rosa. If you have news or an event you'd like to share with our listeners, be sure to tell us about it by going to our own website at outbeatradio.com. Just click on Outbeat News. For Gary Carnevale, I'm Greg Moralia. Now back to Outbeat Collage with Michaela Cannon and Gary Carnevale.
Thank you.
Welcome back, and you are listening to Outbeat Collage. I'm so delighted to have on the line Dale Smith. Dale holds an MFA in creative writing. He has a master's degree in biblical studies, and he currently teaches for the English department at Virginia Commonwealth University in Richmond, Virginia. Dale is also the author and performer of a one-man stage play entitled Jesus Freak, The Story of a Very Unlikely Disciple. Dale, welcome to Outbeat Collage.
Thank you, Michaela. I'm flattered to be on the show and excited about my visit to Santa Rosa that's coming up.
Good, good. All right, so Jesus Freak, P-H-R-E-A-K.
Yes.
It's a somewhat autobiographical work. Actually, it is you who are the unlikely disciple in this play, which actually dares to ask some hard questions about what it means to be a person of faith in a faith tradition that really doesn't want you to be there. Give us a sense of what the play is all about.
All right. I want to stress, you said the play is a somewhat autobiographical work. I want to stress the somewhat. The guy in the play, although his name is Dale, his life is a lot more eventful than mine has ever been and probably ever will be. But that said, I do connect emotionally with this character all the way through the show. Now, about what the play is about. The Dale in the show is a church pianist at this little country church in rural Virginia. He's extremely cynical. He's an agnostic. And lo and behold, he has a strange dream about Jesus that he can't quite explain away. And it is this spiritual experience for him, and it scares him to death. And he does his best throughout the show to run from it comically as much as he can. And he actually explains He actually makes himself feel better by thinking, okay, if this dream is real and God is really calling me through this Jesus figure, at least I can rest assured that the church doesn't want me. And that actually becomes a safety net, sort of this ironic safety net for him that God may want him, but the church wouldn't accept him. So the show sort of turns the gay faith experience on its head, the typical gay faith experience on its head. Instead of someone being run out of the church, you get this character who is running from the church. But there is someone in the show, a character that I do, who did get run out of his church. So that experience is there.
Mm-hmm.
That was a lot. I'm sorry.
That's okay. What was behind your inspiration to write the play and then ultimately take it on the road?
Well, I went to seminary in my 30s, and there was a class project. We had to do a project in this class called Images of Jesus, where at the end of the class, we could do either a presentation on an image of Jesus that we found interesting that an artist had done, or we could create our own. And I had been playing around with monologues and things like that, and I went up and asked the professor if I could do a monologue for my project. And he looked at me sort of curiously, and he's like, if you want to. So the day came, and there were 10 or 12 PowerPoint presentations, and then I got up and told some jokes and sang a little bit. And it was all about this dream that I had. Like the Dale in the show, I had this strange dream about Jesus on a Good Friday, no less, just like in the show. And so the little monologue was about that. It was about 10 minutes long, and I thought, that's it. And then people would stop me on campus who were in the class, and they were like, Dale, what happens next? I'm like, there isn't a next. That was it. But they kept saying it. And so then I started thinking, well, if there is a next for this, what would happen? And at the time, I was commuting on the weekends to this job I had, and I had a tape recorder in the car. This was back when people had tape recorders still. And I had a tape recorder in the car, and I would just start talking into it and you know, sort of putting this show together. And it took about 2 years, mm-hmm. I think, before I had something that was about full length. And then I would invite people over to the house. I'd feed them. I'd be like, just here, have a beer, have some pizza. Just watch me do this so you can tell me what it is. And I did that for a while. And then I entered the script into a play festival. It got into a play festival. I got to work with the director, which was amazing. It got a good response in the play festival, and then I started sending out information, trying to take it other places. And my first on-the-road gig was actually at my alma mater, my undergrad alma mater, James Madison University. And the kids who booked it had no idea I was an alum. I thought that was the only reason they booked me, but it wasn't.
Well, you use, I think what's interesting as I've read about it is that you use a lot of parable and metaphor in the context of the play. Give us a sense of what or how that works in the context of a play that has this kind of an edge to it and potentially could be misunderstood.
Right. I'm glad you brought that up. Earlier, when we were talking, we talked about how the character in the show makes himself feel better by thinking the church wouldn't want me, the church won't accept me. Well, we are talking as if the character is gay, but in the world of the show, I never mention the word gay. In the world of the show, there is a metaphor for being gay, for being an outcast, for being whatever you want to think you are, and that is a mixer. And I take that from Leviticus 19:19, mm-hmm. Which says something along the lines of, you shall not wear garments made of two different materials. And in the world of the show, there are 10% of the population that are born with a skin condition that does not allow them to wear clothes that are made of 100% cotton. And these people, therefore, have to wear polyester cotton blends and are mixers.
Mm.
So that is the metaphor that I use for the gay issue in the show. Now, why did I use this? I want to talk a little bit about why I used it and then quickly say what I think it's doing.
Okay.
When I started expanding the show from just that 10-minute monologue for my seminary class, I knew I wanted to talk about the gay issue. I'm like, if I'm going to do a whole show, I want to talk about what it's like being a gay Christian. But I knew that even if I had well-meaning liberal audiences, that if halfway through the show I came out to them and they'd been laughing and giggling and blah, blah, blah all the way through, and then I come out, I felt like even well-meaning pro-gay liberal audiences would stop laughing and be thinking, oh, this is serious now. I've got to be supportive. And so the metaphor, I think, allows the comic tone to continue.
Mm-hmm.
So it's almost pretty much the midway point when the character comes out as a mixer to the audience. And it's interesting watching audiences. It takes about 15, 30 seconds, I guess, for them to figure out what I'm talking about. They'll be like, sort of like nervously laughing, like, what is he talking about? We don't really get it. And then you see light bulbs go off, bop, 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 over
wow.
their head.
Uh-huh.
And they're with me. And they get it. And they laugh. And I think especially when I've done the show in churches that are, say, wanting to be more welcoming, but maybe the whole congregation isn't there yet, the fact that this allows them to talk about the issue without having to have the word there frees them up somehow, and they're able to laugh with me about it.
Right, right. As we wind up the interview here, let's go right to that. You're going to be performing at Thanksgiving Lutheran Church, which is at 1225 Fulton Road here in Santa Rosa. They are a reconciling congregation, which means they are accepting of people of all faiths and looks and statuses and economics and across the board. You're going to be doing two performances that evening, correct? This is Saturday, May 5th.
Yes, one at 4 and one at 7.
Okay.
And I think it's $5 each for the show. They're keeping the price down, wanting to make it affordable for everybody. And you can buy tickets on their website at thanksgivinglutheran.org.
Right. And if we want to know more about the play itself and about you, the website is?
Jesus-freak.com, and that's P-H-R-E-A-K. And there are two videos on the website. There's mm-hmm. There are some interviews with me, some write-ups. There's a lot of information there.
Right, right. Even the videos are entertaining.
Oh, well, thank you.
I think it's going to be a fabulous show. I'm going to be there, and
I'm
hope
glad. I'm excited to meet you.
Absolutely, and I hope that this draws an even huger audience than is anticipated. It's been such a pleasure. I don't want to cut this too short, but I need to move on, and I'm just going to save the rest of the questions until we actually meet in person. How's that?
That sounds good. I'm sorry I talk so much.
No, you did absolutely fine. I'm just cramming a lot into tonight's show. So I'm just going to, as I said, saving my questions, and I really, really am excited that you're going to be in town.
Oh, well, thank you so much for having me on the show.
You're most, most welcome. Thank you for your courage, for daring to examine and explore these kinds of questions, and actually inspiring us to not be afraid to ask those bigger questions of our own faith and our own belief systems. So we'll look forward to seeing you in a few weeks, okay?
All right. Thank you very much. Have a good night.
Very good. Thanks, Dale.
All
bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
And there you go, folks. Tickets are available at www.thanksgivinglutheran.org. If you want to know more about the play itself and about Dale, it's www.jesus-freak, P as in Paul, H-R-E-A-K.com. For more information, do feel free to contact Jan Thomas. Her number is 836-7773, or do go to the websites. Let's take a musical break. I'll be right back with Susan Castlin.
You're listening to Outbeat Collage here on KRCB-FM. Join KRCB in celebrating the Big Read by reading Bless Me Ultima by Rudolfo Anaya. The Big Read is an initiative of the National Endowment of the Arts designed to restore reading in the center of American life. The Big Read is sponsored in part by your North Bay unicycler, the Ratto Group, a family of companies where every day is Earth Day. Support for Outbeat on KRCB-FM comes from members and from the Napa Valley Opera House, welcoming world-class artists and entertainers to the stage. Located in the heart of downtown Napa, this historic venue hosts Suzanne Vega and Duncan Sheik on Tuesday, April 17th, Women Fully Clothed on April 20th, and Lisa Loeb on Saturday, April 21st. The Napa Valley Opera House. For a complete schedule, nvoh.org or 707-226-7372. And now, back to Outbeat Collage with your host, Michaela Kennan.
Welcome back, and if you're just tuning in, we've been talking to Dale Smith. He is the author and performer of the stage play Jesus Freak, the story of a very unlikely disciple. He'll be performing that here in Santa Rosa coming up on May 5th. And recapping the music you're hearing tonight, a bit of jazzy take on a couple of traditional hymns and folk tunes, starting out with We Gather Together, followed up with Holy, 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 all of these from the Christian and Network Music Jazz Ensemble. Susan Caslin is a writer of LGBTQ nonfiction. She's a San Francisco resident who personally knew of the huge character and extraordinary work of the late Father Richard Purcell. She is herself a kind of spiritual pilgrim on a personal faith journey. She's written various works which have appeared in Out Now, Entre Nous, El Tecolote, and she is also the author of a chapbook entitled 24th Street and Other Poems, inspired by the lower 24th Street corridor in San Francisco. I actually had the personal pleasure of meeting Susan recently. She was in town doing some book readings of her latest work, Conversations with Richard Purcell, The Adventures and Reflections of a Renegade Priest. This is the story of an openly gay Franciscan brother who ran a homeless shelter in San Francisco's Mission District for over 20 years. It's an engaging story, a fascinating read. Susan, welcome to Outbeat Collage. It's great to talk with you.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Most welcome. What was it about the life and work of Richard Purcell that you felt was a story that needed to be told?
Well, as you described, Richard was an openly gay Franciscan priest who ran a homeless shelter in the Intermission District for men with AIDS. He named the shelter Marty's Place after his brother, Marty Purcell, who died of AIDS in San Francisco in 1989. And Richard had come to the city to take care of him, and after he died, he opened up this shelter. Richard, in his earlier part of his life, he had lived for 20 years with Native Americans in southern Arizona, and he based a lot of his spiritual beliefs on the teachings of the Native Americans. And he was quite a character. He was very charismatic. A lot of people considered him a spiritual teacher. He was a very funny man. And I got to know him. I was very moved by him, and I started to hang out at Marty's Place and was very moved by the scene that was going on there, especially after Richard himself became ill with Lou Gehrig's disease, or ALS, mm-hmm. and ended up dying. He spent most of his illness at Marty's Place being cared for by people who cared about him, and including a lot of the homeless men who had AIDS who he had helped care for. So it was quite an interesting scene. The house became sort of a community center where there was a lot going on, and Richard's dying was the center of it. So I was very moved by the scene and decided to write about it.
And is that how you met Richard, through that context?
I moved to San Francisco in the Intermission District in 2002, and I started attending a church in the Castro District called Most Holy Redeemer. It's a Catholic church which is predominantly actually attended by gay people, and mostly gay people go there, so it's very, very accepting of gay people. And it was through a lot of people through some of the people at the church that I was introduced to Richard. And he actually lived in my neighborhood. We had a lot in common. We were both gay. We both came from Middle America, ended up in San Francisco. We were both Irish Catholic. And I lost my own brother to AIDS in 2003, so we had in common as well.
When his own brother died, of course, Marty's Place opened, named after his brother. Do you think, from what you know, was it simply that event that influenced or inspired him to open the shelter? Or do you think he was responding to maybe a greater sense of mission or a need that he felt needed to be addressed?
Well, he was living as a Franciscan friar since he was a young man, and that meant living and working with the poor in whatever situation he was in. And for 20 years, he lived on an Indian reservation and worked with Native Americans. He also worked with Haitian refugees for a while in Florida, and he worked with some people in the Bowery in New York City for a while. And he found himself in San Francisco after his brother died. And, of course, this was 1989, right at the height of the AIDS epidemic.
Mm-hmm.
So he saw it was like people were suffering all around him, and he just saw there was a need. And he had developed a philosophy at that point in his life where he felt that you should bloom, what he called, you bloom where you're planted.
Right.
And he kind of lived day by day. So it wasn't, he never did things like planning in the future as to where he would end up. And he just decided, well, this was where he was meant to be. He was living in a flat. It was a one-bedroom apartment on Hartford Street in the Castro, which was where his brother died. And when Richard came to San Francisco, he didn't have any money. And his brother didn't have any money because of his illness. So Their sister Marge Yeager helped them out and helped them get this apartment. It was a one-bedroom apartment on Hartford Street. So after Marty died, Richard just started bringing people into that apartment to live, people that were homeless, and started this homeless shelter in that apartment. They had as many as like four people living in that one-bedroom apartment, and then started using his influence as a priest and his engaging personality to solicit funds, keep that going, and that's how Marty's Place started.
Mm-hmm.
And then in 1993, he got some more money together and ended up purchasing an old Victorian in the Mission District, and that was the second and final Marty's Place.
And did people actually live there, or was it kind of a sleeping place, and then they'd be on the streets during the day?
No. They lived there.
Okay.
And that was what made it different, I think, than a lot of other institutions or nonprofit agencies. It was their home. And if they were fortunate enough to get into it, they could stay there until they died. And it was never a big scale operation. It was more quality rather than quantity. I think there were, in the larger Marty's Place, there were no more than eight men at a time living in the building. But once they got in there, that was their home, and that was their home, and it was their family.
Mm-hmm.
And Richard did not take any government money, so he never had to impose any kind of government bureaucracy or regulation on the situation.
And I'm going to guess that since it was in the Mission District, it was largely a Latino population.
Yeah, it was mostly men of color that ended up there, and mostly Latino. There were a lot of immigrants that were living there, and some of them, and they were mostly gay men, although there were some straight men, but many of the immigrants that I met had fled some really dangerous homophobic situations in their own country, you know, and one man in particular told me he had almost been killed by the police there because he was gay. And Richard helped some of these men get asylum in the United States.
Mm-hmm.
As a priest to get asylum, which is very difficult to get for sexual orientation or for their AIDS status.
And I think at one point you had mentioned the film La Misión by Peter Bratt, that it's filmed in the Mission District and gives you a good insight as to the culture and the attitudes towards the gay Latino person or even a person of another color. Do you think that movie was kind of an accurate reflection of the climate around Marty's Place?
I live in the Mission myself, and there is mostly Latino people living here. I liked that film because I thought it kind of gave an accurate description of the Mission and perhaps some of the opinions about gays among some Latinos, although certainly not all of them, maybe some older Latinos, but I guess what I feel, or what I have felt living in the Mission, especially when I first moved here, was that I felt like I wasn't a minority because I was, for one thing, white, also because I was gay. And how do you fit into this culture where a lot of it is based on, you know, people having strong family ties?
Mm-hmm.
You know, I experienced myself feeling some alienation when I first moved here. How do I get past some of these cultural barriers or language barriers? And I think hanging out at Marty's Place helped me with that a lot because, you know, I got to know the Latino men, and I related to them easier because they were gay. And so it kind of helped me maybe build bridges toward understanding my neighbors. And I started to learn the language and learn how to speak Spanish better than I had before. So
mm-hmm.
I think it's, you know, it's unfortunate, or it just is. The situation is that a lot of gays end up in the inner city where they're because we come from somewhere else where maybe we didn't feel welcome. We end up with other people that are also from other places, and there's barriers to us understanding each other, but in some ways we may have a lot in common.
Sure, sure. Now, you mentioned that Richard had an extremely funny side to him, a real good sense of humor. Just share with us a story or two about who Richard was in the midst of all of these guys and how he kind of handled the day-to-day routine.
Well, I mean, there was really nothing to say about the day-to-day routine until he got sick. It was just a place where people lived, and they cooked. They got a lot of their food from the food bank. They cooked together. They hung out together. And before there were any good AIDS drugs, a lot of them died quite quickly.
Mm-hmm.
But once they started getting AIDS drugs, the men were surviving longer, and, you know, some of them going to work and things like that. And then actually what happened was the issue of chemical dependency became more prominent.
How interesting.
Because before, if people had trouble with chemical dependency, which, you know, many people did, in any group, there's certainly a lot of that that goes around, but there was, in this situation, if you're dealing with a homeless population, they would just die, and it wasn't a problem. But once they were surviving, then it became a problem. So Richard had to deal with, you know, if they were using or drinking in the house, how did he handle that? And,
mm-hmm.
you know, that was a challenge for him. But, you know, I think he dealt with it pretty well. Anyway, not to veer off into that subject. I'm sorry. You were talking about his humor.
That's okay.
Yeah, he was really funny. And I think one thing he taught us was that life is very funny if we start looking at it from a certain perspective. And that's why I think he enjoyed life so much, was that he was kind of an observer. And if you sort of shift your perspective, you realize that some things in life are really humorous, depending on how you look at them. So I learned that from him. But just to give an example, he was real quick with jokes and with comebacks. And he also, like, for instance, there was a big fight one Thanksgiving because there were vegetarians in our community that wanted no turkey, and the other group wanted turkey. And he was telling me the story about this big fight. He said, oh, it was just terrible. He said, oh, there were feathers flying everywhere.
Oh, jeez.
He also gave nicknames to everything. He'd give all of his friends nicknames, and all of even inanimate objects he would give nicknames, especially the medical devices he used. So it kind of made them less clinical too.
Sure.
For instance, he called when he had to have a bowel movement, he called it going to visit Mrs. Murphy.
Yeah.
If he'd have to be transferred to the commode, he would yell out, "Mrs. Murphy is calling."
Good.
We called ourselves the circle of care, the people that were caring for him. And about once a month, we would have meetings, and there were the circle of care meetings. And he would call them call it the circle jerk.
Oh.
And if you've hung around gay men, you realize what that means.
Of course.
But, he was always filled with little lines like that.
That's great. So he was diagnosed as having Lou Gehrig's disease. When was that?
He was diagnosed in 2006.
Okay.
And, so he died in 2011.
And did his health deteriorate quickly, or was it a gradual process?
Well, at the time, it seemed very gradual, because it wasn't something we could see on a day-to-day basis. But if you looked at it over time, it was steady. Like, you know, he started out, first of all, using a cane, then a walker, then being, you know, into a wheelchair, and then to bed, and then, you know... So he gradually became completely paralyzed, starting with his feet all the way up, until he was completely a quadriplegic, and he couldn't move anything. But gratefully, he was able to talk until the end. And a lot of people with ALS, they lose the ability to speak, which is a real loss.
I see.
But for him, he could talk, so he could communicate and listen. And that was his greatest gift, I think, was to tell stories and to counsel people. People were always standing in line to spend time with him and to listen to his words of wisdom and to receive counseling from him. And he was very alert until the very day he died, aware of what was going on.
And did the roles kind of change where he was more or less the caretaker? As he grew more frail, did the residents kind of come around and engage in part of the caretaking as well?
Oh, yeah, that was it. I mean, he had to completely rely on all of us to care for him. He became completely dependent on everything, although he could still talk, and he still had a lot of control in how things went. In fact, he dictated a lot of what went on in the house day to day. He didn't die in Marty's place, because at the very end, due to some funding issues, he had to be transferred to a nursing home. But we were all wondering, would he die, because he didn't want to leave Marty's place. He really didn't want to leave, but someone said, well, I don't think he's going to die until he leaves, because he cares too much about what goes on in his house. And, you know, maybe he had to just physically leave in order to lose control and let go. And that's what he did. He did die after he left a few months.
I see. You tell a story about his cardboard coffin. Share that with us.
Well, when he found out he was dying, he went ahead and made his own coffin out of a cardboard box. And I guess this was in line with being a Franciscan and living in poverty. He didn't see any point in spending a lot of money on a coffin. And he was an artist, so he painted it with all kinds of colorful stripes and little sayings such as, I told you I was sick, all's well that ends well, and I love happy endings. That's what he wrote on there.
Of course, all the way up to the end, I'm sure.
Yeah, and then on the top of the coffin were the footprints of a coyote, which represent the trickster in Native American symbolism. And another symbol, which is, he lived with the Tohono O'odham Native Americans, and they have a symbol, you may have seen it. It's a picture of a maze with a little stick man on top of the maze. And that maze represents the road that all of us walk through in life, and we meet challenges along the way. But if we follow what he called I'itoi, or the Earth Maker, we will find our way to the eternal life at the end. But if we don't follow the Earth Maker, then we'll get lost.
And he surely did that, didn't he?
Yeah, he appeared to. Yes.
Yeah. So what is happening with Marty's place now? Are there plans to keep it open?
Well, Richard, you know, it was just by a fluke that he was able to get that building, which is now worth about $2 million. He had absolutely no money when he acquired this building. He was just able to not only get the building, but get people to volunteer for Marty's place, including a lawyer, an accountant. Everybody who worked for that place did so voluntarily. So he got the funding for the place, and then when he realized he was going to die, he said, why don't we just give this building away? And people were just like, what? We're going to give away a $2 million building? And like, yeah, I mean, it's always existed in this spirit since I started it. So why should things change when I die? So after they discussed it, that was the decision. They would give it away to another AIDS organization. And they did an extensive search, and they came up with Dolores Street Services, which does similar work, although they do take government funding. And so they own the building now. It was given to them, and they're renovating it. They have a caregiver living in it right now, and they're renovating it. And they have funding issues, too, before they can actually start bringing in clients. But the plan is it will reopen, and it will be called Marty's Place.
And will it still serve the HIV population, or
what I understand, but, you know, you can't really quote me on that. I'm not sure, but that's my understanding.
Yeah, yeah. So professionally now, you are a nurse, and I think that I recall when we met that you mentioned that you teach nursing. Is that correct?
Yeah, that's mostly what I do. I'm a teacher.
Okay.
Yeah.
How has your connection with the life and work of Richard actually enlightened your own sense of compassion. And do you try and convey that to your students as well?
I think knowing Richard has changed the way I interact with everybody, you know, not just on my job, but just all the individuals that I come into contact with in my life, in that I'm more in the moment and more open to the possibilities of interactions with people. Whereas I think a lot of us, sometimes we take the people around us for granted, or our daily routines for granted, and we're like, oh, yeah, here we go, same old thing. But now I'm more open to, like, getting to know my students as individuals, when I work with patients, with them as individuals, and just being open to what's going to happen next. And that's made my life a lot more fresh and interesting and exciting. And also, I think it's influenced my relationships in a more positive way. I think as far as, you know, talking about being a nurse, I think one thing I looked at when I was caring for Richard is something I knew, but I grew to know it even deeper, was that I wasn't always the best nurse for him, even though I have probably had more education than any of the volunteers. And that's because I've moved away from bedside nursing, and I'm more of an academic now. And I've done what a lot of medical care workers do, is that because I've had an opportunity for more education, I've gotten an easier job, physically easier job. But that doesn't mean the work I'm doing is as important as, you know, the kind of work it takes to care for someone like that had ALS, which was very difficult. It was, you know, I don't know if you've met anyone who's a quadriplegic, but it's extremely taxing. And some of the caregivers there did such an incredible job, and they had no education in the field at all. And it just made me realize that we don't value that type of work in this society. And it's often, you know, people of color doing the work and not getting paid much for it, not getting much respect for it, yet it's so important. And then, of course, the disabled people that aren't able to care for themselves, they especially suffer because we don't value that work.
Sure, sure. Do you, when I know that you write poems and maybe some other kinds of short stories and things, do you pull in this kind of theme throughout most of your writings? Is it about spirituality and?
I don't really know about that. In writing poetry, you just write whatever comes through you. So I guess so. I mean, I think if you look at life the way Richard looked at it, everything is sacred and everything is spiritual. So if you're writing about life, then, you know, I just hopefully that will come through.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And any other plans in the works for a sequel to Richard's story? Or is it a little
early? No, not right now. You know, I'm continuing to write, and, you know, hopefully I will, you know, be able to publish another book sometime. But no, not at this point, not with as far as Richard. And, you know, I think, you know, the thing about Richard was that, you know, he was all about change and about moving forward in life. One of his favorite sayings was, life is change, and to change often is to live well. And I think that fits in with the noble truth in Buddhism, that life is impermanent. And that's why he didn't fear death, because he said this is just the process of living. It's always something new, and we're just moving into another direction. And now that he's gone, I don't think he would want us to just keep focusing on him or even focusing on this book. He would like us to just move forward in our own lives and see what comes up next. And that's what made life so interesting for him. You know, even though he was stuck in a wheelchair at the end and couldn't move, he still took a lot of interest in life and joy, because it was always new.
Yeah, and that's a gift, isn't it, to be able to look at the eyes minute by minute, or look at the world minute by minute through fresh eyes.
Yeah, for sure.
Yeah. Okay. Again, the book is entitled Conversations with Richard Purcell, The Adventures and Reflections of a Renegade Priest. How can we get a copy and find out more about the book?
I think you could just go online. It's on Amazon.com, or maybe you could find another line that sells it cheaper. Just, you know, give it a take a look at that. Or you could go to my website, which is www.susancaslin.com. I'm also going to be speaking this week, Wednesday night. I'll be speaking at 7:30 p.m. at Most Holy Redeemer Church in San Francisco. So I'm going to be talking about the book at that time, and I'm going to be joined by Jerry Betts, who is going to give us some insights into Franciscan spirituality.
Wow. That's great. Good. I wish that it was a closer opportunity for me to be there. That's fine. And is your 24th Street Book of Poems available?
Yeah, you could get that on my website as well.
Okay. All right. Very good. Well, I want to again say thank you. Glad that I could reconnect with you and that you've introduced us to yourself and to Richard. I'm thinking that we should all have kind of a renegade priest in our lives just to remind us how much we're all a part of each other and how greatly we are gifted because of that.
All right. Well, thanks for having me, Michaela.
Well, it's my pleasure. Let's connect again, okay?
And all right.
The best
take care.
To you and everything.
All righty.
All right. Thanks so much.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. Okay, and once again, my thanks to both of our guests this evening, author Susan Caslin and performer Dale Smith. Do be sure and catch Jesus Freak here in Santa Rosa on May 5th. Again, go to www.thanksgivinglutheran.org for more information for the tickets. I do hope to see you there. Next month on Outbeat Collage, it is pre-Pride Month, if you can believe that. Gary and I will be talking to Andrea Van Duke from the Occidental Center for the Arts and our fabulous Sister Scarlett Equality Billows from the Sonoma County Pride Planning Committee is going to join us. She will chat about the many talented performers that will be gracing the Pride Festival stage this year. And we heard last week from Sister Sarah that there is going to be no rain. It's going to be beautiful and sunny. So do mark that weekend on your calendar. We're going to just kind of go out with a reminder to tune into Outbeat Music next month as well. I have an extra special guest on that show. I'm going to be talking with reggae artist Mista Maja P. He is a Bay Area artist from Jamaica, featuring the music from his new CD release, Tolerance. He's written 11 original songs exclusively in support of the LGBT community. It's out. It's just in time for Pride, and it's something all of us should have in our CD collection. As always, my great thanks to Mary Moore Campagna for engineering this evening, to KRCB-FM Community Powered Radio, to you, our Outbeat listeners. As always, have a great week. Remember to be real, be remarkable, and do tune in. Again, I'll see you next time. Bye-bye.